Yeah, I'll go ahead and say, unfortunately, I have to like catch an airplane immediately after, so if you see me bolting out of here, it's not because of a lack of confidence in my talk. I have to catch an airplane immediately after this.
Our next speaker is Seth Hart, who has an airplane to catch, and he's talking on Plato meets Darwin, and I'm really hoping that there's an image of that
event. Oh gosh, it's going to be disappointing, unfortunately. So, I'm a humanities scholar, and we have this really annoying thing where we read from scripts. And I don't like it, but unfortunately that is how I prep for this, so I pray you forgive me. I know it's not as engaging, but I will be a little bit more tied to this. Many of the controversies within evolutionary creationism or theistic evolution surround the possibilities, mode, and extent of God's action within the evolutionary process. However, this model of God often presupposes conceptions of divine providence and action that emerged only with the rise of modernity. Within the modern context, causation is reduced to what ancient and medieval commentators regarded as a version of efficient causation, I'll explain that in a sec, conceived as mere transference of force. Prior to the modern era, though, theories of causation were more complex and, dare I say, metaphysically sophisticated. It was these theories of causation that early and medieval Christians adopted, and it is a view that, I will argue, offers us a model of God's causal activity that is compatible with contemporary evolutionary biology. I will begin by outlining the Neoplatonic conception of causation before applying it to two distinct areas of biology, namely biological fitness and recent discoveries concerning development. I only have limited time to broadly outline 2,000 years of philosophical history along with its application to contemporary biology, so please bear with me if I move too quickly or in overly broad strokes. So what is this pre-modern understanding of divine causation? Well, great Christian thinkers such as Augustine and Thomas Aquinas inherited a view that is known to philosophers as Neoplatonism. For thinkers in this tradition, God is identified with the form or idea of the good. To start at the beginning of the tradition, for Plato, the idea of the good takes center stage in the Republic, acting as the highest unitive principle for all other forms. While the good is also positioned as the font of truth and being, its role as the ultimate goal of all action takes equal precedence. For the later tradition that accepted Plato, the former idea of the good was universally equated with God himself. Unsurprisingly, Christians found the Platonic system, whereby God serves as both source and end, to be a welcome pagan ally. According to this system, all four Aristotelian causes were part of any causal event. The efficient cause, the thing causing the change, the formal cause, the identity of the thing in question, the material cause, the stuff from which something's made, and the most important thing if you get from this is the final cause, the good end towards which it is seeking. Since God on this system was the good beyond all goods, God was the foundation for all natural motion. Since the particular goods of all finite beings are derived from God's goodness via a doctrine called participation. Put simply, God was the end towards which the whole cosmos was directed. And for the Christian tradition, this fact was readily accepted despite its pagan source. This is clearly evident in St. Augustine's famous words, "You have made us for yourself, and restless is our heart until it comes to rest in you." For these thinkers, God himself, as the form of the good, acted as the measure of goodness for creaturely beings. Final causes did not make sense to these thinkers, except via their relationship to God, who was the source for such ends. Thus, the very act of a creature seeking its own good is identical to the pursuit of greater participation in God. Moreover, even while creaturely goods are wildly distinct, the lion hunting the gazelle is antithetical to the gazelle's desire to escape, they are each directed to God, goodness itself. In the eloquent words of Jan Erikson, "The things which are, as it were, dispersed, insofar as they are ordained to their own different ends, are gathered in directness to this final end, God himself." He continues, "Because God is the universal good, every creature naturally loves him more than it does itself." This is a radically different notion of causation than we moderns tend to suppose. When we think of causation, we do not normally associate it with ends or goals, unless, of course, it deals with conscious agents. I would love to get into why this is and why William of Ockham is to blame, but I must move on to an application of this distinct causal system to our interpretation of biological models, so please excuse the rather sudden transition. It goes without saying that biologists, more than any other fields, continue to employ language of final causes. This is especially true regarding language around behavior, adaptations, and development. Yet one field that is supposedly free from this reliance is evolutionary biology. Darwin, we are told, ridded us of final causes and language about goals and ends. But, as many have noted, that's not always the case. Even in Darwin's own time, indeed, many of the key terms in evolutionary biology are, upon philosophical reflection, highly problematic. While this often goes unnoticed by the practicing biologist, it's become an open secret among the philosophers of biology. What, for instance, is the common feature that fitness is measuring? How are we to interpret the counterfactual possibilities present by the various peaks of a fitness landscape? Terms such as adaptations, natural selection, and fitness are core to the explanatory structure of the modern synthesis. Yet, as John Rice notes, unlike fundamental terms in physics, such as mass, energy, and velocity, these terms currently have no agreed-upon meaning. All these terms deserve their own treatment, but for simplicity, I'll focus on two particular cases, as I noted, biological fitness and development, to make the case that contemporary biology is ripe for synthesis with classical and medieval tradition of Christianity. I begin with biological fitness. Again, it's an open secret in the philosophy of biology that fitness is nearly impossible to define well. As philosophers Ramsey and Pence note, few concepts have elicited such a long and heated debate in the philosophy of biology as that of fitness. The problem can be broadly summarized as the fact that fitness does not denote any single physical property of an organism. Thus, why treat it as a single causal mechanism? Indeed, biologists tend to define it as any trait increasing the propensity for reproductive success. Yet, as philosophers have noted, this reduces it to a tautology and thus evacuates it of an explanatory value. If you actually go to the Stanford Encyclopedia, it's one of the opening lines. The problem has become so severe that a major voice in the philosophy of biology has called for the abandoning of any causal notion of fitness and natural selection. It suggests instead a statistical interpretation of fitness, which, in the words of its proponents, eliminates evolutionary process. That is, it shows that earlier and later states of population fitness or adaptiveness in an evolutionary process should not be considered stages in the unfolding of a fundamental process. While this approach sounds drastic, it has become increasingly common as a means to avoid teleology and has been adopted by some prominent figures, such as David Hanke of Cambridge. What Hanke and others realize is that an easy, though unacceptable, answer is available. Regard fitness as a teleological concept. It is perhaps suggestive that Darwin himself may have opted for this strategy. As philosopher James Lennox has shown, Darwin often appeals to the ends or purpose as the reason behind a trait selection. In fact, Darwin often used the term final cause in his argumentation and consistently maintains that, quote, natural selection acts for the good of each being and that its products are present for various functions, purposes, and ends. Lennox summarizes Darwin's thought as follows. The beneficial consequences of a variation explain why it is selectively favored. He adds, as in domestic selection, the good served by the variation continues to be causally relevant to its increasing frequency or continued presence in a population. My proposal, then, is to return to this more primitive conception of fitness and define it as the product of multiple teleologically related factors. One, the development of a trait's functional traits. Two, the ability of those traits to accomplish their function within their given environment. Three, the performance of a given function in assisting in the development and homeostasis of the organism. And four, the reproductive success of the organism. Each component is for the sake of the next component in the list, teleological term, for the sake of. Thus, there is a teleological ordering of the four aspects of fitness, with the final component having explanatory priority, as Francisco Ayala notes in his treatment of biological teleology. Reproductive success is the end that determines and orders all prior goals. I think this teleological understanding of fitness is not something foreign to our contemporary understanding of biology. Consider evolutionary landscapes, perhaps the most recognizable application of the concept of fitness. The origin of these models dates back to Sewell Wright and the very foundation of the modern synthesis. Wright visualized the evolution of organisms by natural selection as a topography filled with adaptive peaks and valleys. Peaks in these illustrations represent maximal fitness values for a given genotype, phenotype, or allele frequency, while values represent lower grades of fitness. They are, according to Daniel Dennett, quote, a standard imaginative prosthesis for evolutionary theorists. It has proven its worth in literally thousands of applications, including many outside evolutionary theory, end quote. The basic, though by no means universal, rule of these models is that populations will ascend upward via the nearest adaptive peak to levels of higher fitness. In other words, natural selection explores only those peaks local to it. While most illustrations use either a two or three dimensions for the sake of visualization and simplicity, there is no restriction on the number of dimensions one could theoretically include. And in fact, these higher dimensional models present some topological features qualitatively different from our familiar three-dimensional terrain. While some biologists have deemed adaptive landscapes to be purely didactic, George McGee has shown that they can be put to actual analytic practice through the usage of theoretical morphospaces. For perceptive minds, the most obvious interpretation of these models is a teleological one. Samir Okasha, one of the premier philosophers and biologists, has noted, the notion that natural selection pushes populations up adaptive peaks suggests a quasi-teleological view of evolution as a goal-directed process. This ties in with what we call agential thinking, in which the process of natural selection is analogized to an agent's deliberate choices. John Rice similarly remarks, quote, teleology is exemplified by Wright's metaphor of the adaptive landscape. Both authors attempt to bypass the teleological implications of the landscapes, and others have tried similar tests by simply doing away with the models, leaving the problem to lie with the illustrations rather than the concepts that ground it. Yet if, as I've noted, biological fitness is fundamentally teleological, then it should perhaps not surprise us that such models prove so heuristically valuable. Yet this model might still give the impression that individual life forms are fundamentally passive in the process of evolution. Far from it. And recent discoveries seem to suggest just how much agency organisms have in the evolutionary process. Let's return to the four components of fitness: development, functionality, survival, and reproduction. I could easily argue for why each of these four components of fitness is teleological, citing the work of Alan Plantinga on functionality, Hans Jonas on survival, or Rob Coons and Alex Proust on reproduction, but I'll instead focus on development, the first component of fitness, because more recent discoveries broadly grouped within the extended evolutionary synthesis, the EES, has strengthened the case for biological teleology. I'll cite only two examples. First, developmental plasticity. As Dennis Alexander has already noted in his conference, the idea that a gene possesses a singular representation of some future functional phenotypic trait has fallen on hard times. If genes are merely the byproducts of stochastic mutations, the origin of functional traits would seem to be explained by a more ontologically basic random process. However, if the expression of genes is mediated by gene regulatory networks, the process begins to look far more purposive. And in fact, such regulation, resulting in phenotypic plasticity, is an integral part of development and, consequently, evolution. Phenotypic plasticity signifies an organism's ability to react to new phenotypic and ecological inputs with a change of form, state, movement, or activity. For instance, if one new phenotypic trait is introduced, the whole organism can accommodate this novelty. Yet if such accommodation requires its own fortuitous mutation, and I'll quote a scientific paper here, quote, the waiting time can be prohibitively long and the probability of subsequent loss through drift can be high. Thankfully for the organism, the various interconnected systems can respond adaptively and to changes in circumstances. In fact, in one extreme example, Oxytrichia trifalis is capable of rewriting 90% of its somatic genome. Thus, genes do not represent a precise phenotype, but rather co-create the organism in conversation with environmental and developmental factors. While a conserved core of processes is maintained across all multicellular species, these combine with an array of highly plastic, variable features that produce facilitated variations, which maximize phenotypic options while minimizing their inherent lethality. To quote philosopher Dennis Walsh, quote, adaptive evolution is not ineluctably chancy. It is inherent in the purposiveness of organisms. Second, the DNA damage repair system, or the DDR. One of the foundational presuppositions of the modern synthesis has been the static nature of an organism's genome. However, a growing body of empirical evidence has revealed that the integrity of this code only results from adaptive responses by the organism. The DDR is an intricate series of mechanisms designed to restore and alter the structure of damaged DNA. For humans, DNA lesions occur tens or even hundreds of thousands of times per cell per day, and any lesions left unrepaired may result in severe repercussions. As such, the responses of the cells are multifarious and specified to unique attributes of the damaged DNA structure. Thus, the causal asymmetry often presupposed by the modern synthesis, immutable genes giving rise to functional traits, reveals itself to be too simplistic. Genes are not only generate functional traits, but are themselves preserved by a complex functional system adapted to respond to the specific needs of DNA maintenance. In other words, to explain the stability of DNA structure, one needs to invoke the goals, the final causes, of the DDR. To sum up my many points, organismal development is a teleological process, and it belongs to a greater hierarchical teleological chain that determines biological fitness. Thus, I provocatively conclude that natural selection can be regarded as a teleological process. I take some flack for that. And it is one that is consistently being mapped by our best evolutionary landscapes. The drive towards fitness peaks is not merely a heuristically valuable illustration. Instead, it is heuristically valuable because it is a teleological process. Evolution is driven, at least at some level, by the good. Now to draw the two threads together. If there are objective goods for biological organisms, Christian Platonism would have the resources to metaphysically account for the origin of these goods and would regard them as reflections and participations in God's own goodness. In natural selection's orientation towards these goods, the Christian might read these as a striving of nature towards its divine infinite source. In other words, a biological world filled with creatures directed towards good ends is exactly what a Christian Platonist would expect to find from her investigations. To put it provocatively, it is the Christian, not the atheist, who is in the best philosophical position to account for the models and concepts that form the foundation of contemporary evolutionary theory. Indeed, with the adoption of this more ancient causal system, the entire evolutionary process can be read through a theological lens. Fitness landscapes would be maps of actual creaturely goods and the striving of organisms to better replicate divine goodness in their own particular way, and by the way they participate in the being of God. The clear goal orientation of developmental processes that is just now coming into view would only reinforce this further, revealing the capacity of organisms to individually, and not just collectively, reach towards their God-given ends. Evolution, then, might be seen as an act of worship, a striving towards God and an attempt to replicate God's goodness, however imperfectly, in creation. Well, it'd be nice to say this is a proof of God's role in the evolutionary process. That conclusion might be premature. As noted, a statisticalist interpretation is still available to non-theists, though it would entail the denial of the traditional view of Darwinism. My more modest proposal is that Christian Platonism provides a welcome metaphysical framework for understanding biology, one that opens new, or perhaps old, conversations about the relationship of theology to biology. Undoubtedly, many questions could be leveled against this proposal, as it is a radical departure from the assumed metaphysics of biology. Nevertheless, I propose the advantages of this framework for interpreting biology prove their value, and as such, the view is worthy of further consideration by theologian, philosopher, and biologist alike. Thanks.
Hey, Seth, really good job. Thanks a lot. Could you go back to the slide on DDR? Part of your argument that was that, like, because DNA produces this, like, self-repair, mm-hmm. that sort of applies it to the biological end, why can't you just see, like, the the repair mechanism as one of the many mechanisms that the DNA produces.
Why can't you just see it as one of the many mechanisms? So the question is that, when it comes to causation, right? If we want to give a mechanical explanation, we can't. Absolutely, right? Remember the four causes I talked at the beginning? That would be an explanation by efficient cause. My whole point is that that's not explanatorily complete. You also need the final cause, which is, why is it doing this? And I think that there's an added content there, which is it's doing this to maintain the stability of the DNA, replicators. And so, I mean, I think that's part of the explanation for why that exists for organisms, why they have the DDR to begin with. If you accept that, then all of a sudden you accept that the explanatory nature of the DDR incorporates both efficient and final causes. So I think it's just one piece of evidence towards the idea that teleology, these final causes, form part of our explanatory sort of options, or like we need these sort of final causes if we're going to have a comprehensive account of why organisms are the way they are. And Dennis Walsh, if you want to know, he's a philosopher, he's not a theist. He's making some of these, he's actually the one I'm drawing from. He's making these arguments that you cannot understand the DDR without teleological reasoning.
Next question.
Thank you for the talk. I really like the idea that introduced the, you know, lens of metaphysics and teleological purpose to actually inform evolution. We did the molecular dynamic simulation of the DNA molecules, a small segment of the DNA molecules. So that is actually see how it changes at the room temperature as a, in the solution, like a human body. So we find that, you know, the molecule is highly plastic and it's so easy to change the form and so easy to get entangled with each other. So it's hard to, with the teleological kind of, you know, information, it's really impossible to keep the DNA molecules to its normal function or its normal, even normal stable structure. So that's my my question is, how can you actually, you know, introduce this metaphysical element to the theory,
Yeah, so if I can sort of say it back just to make sure I'm understanding. Basically, it's the malleability that you see, how easy it is to disturb through perturbations might sort of disrupt my idea that it's teleological. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's easy. I mean, my point is not so much, I'm not defining teleology as sort of counterfactually robust in the sense that there's a wide range and it will always return to normal. My point is less about sort of the count of the modal properties, as what philosophers call the range at which it can return back to normal. It's more about the explanatory value of using final causes to understand why such systems exist in the first place, right? And so even if they are easily perturbed through these sorts of processes, I still think the explanation goes through. I don't know, it might disrupt how powerful it is. But I still think that you still, it's still has too much work out.
Is there anything you two could discuss afterwards? We've got more questions.
Yeah, so I'll try to be quick. One of the things this highlights, I think, is that scientifically, especially in evolution but elsewhere, the pressure is to be teleophobic, but people of faith are teleophilic. And I think this is a bit of a conflict. But my question in that context is, intelligent designers have been saying there's teleology in development, evolution, and so on for a long time. So what, how do you see yourself in juxtaposition to that group?
Yeah, that's actually something I'm working on right now. So what I do is I define there's sort of three levels of teleology that you see, and quite often we don't distinguish as well. There's a teleology I'm talking about, which is more Aristotelian, which is just this idea that organisms have goals. You have major figures like George Gaylord Simpson, Theodosius Dobzhansky, Darwin, who believed in that. Then you got more speculative ideas about evolution as a unified process, as a single goal. This is what you get like Terry Chardin, Alfred Russel Wallace, and Steve Morris. I'm not making a claim about that. And this is where I sometimes, like, people get confused. But there's a third level, which is that God is a sort of foundation to this whole process. So I am claiming that. So I put myself in that category of God as the foundation. But that's, I fully consider that a theological, philosophical position. It's the first idea, which is, you know, actually has quite a strong history in biological history. You know, like, who's going to say George Gaylord Simpson or Dobzhansky is not a major figure for evolutionary biology? It's that tradition that I'm really sort of putting myself in and saying, yeah, let's look at this.
Okay, Seth, this is a great talk, and I hope we have long discussions after this. I just want to quickly state that it seems to me that your leap to teleology as a cause may be a little premature, perhaps an imposition of a telophilic kind of perspective, as Rob put it. I'm just wondering, why can't this DDR process be viewed as the resulting good is the cause for its survival, not its cause for existence.
Right. So this is the sort of like an ETL. Oh, you want?
No, I'll get it later.
I could just say that there's another aspect of DDR that you didn't mention, which is error-prone repair, which deliberately causes mistakes for the purpose of increasing mutation to allow the population of cells that have been exposed to a toxic agent to mutate to such a high level that a few survive and rebuild the population. If that's not teleology, I don't know what is.
Well, what do you mean by deliberate?
Yeah. We've got to let him catch his plane.
No. I like this. It gets me off the hot seat for a bit.
Don't let him catch his plane.
Stay here another night. I'll go off of that. I actually agree that you could give it that sort of mechanistic explanation. But what I would say is that it's if you reduce it down to that, you're perfectly plausible in doing that. But it also, we have to ask, if I say, why is the DDR there? To ensure that DNA repair system, if this DNA stays in a sort of stable state, have I actually gone beyond what biology is allowed to explain? Am I actually giving an explanatory content by giving a final causal explanation? I would say yes, and I think that's the sort of obvious reading of this. Now, if you say, no, I don't want that, well, that's fine. And that actually not directed to this point, which I don't think is as strong as this point, which is as soon as you get rid of these sort of teleological explanations, someone wants to be a complete reductionist and eliminate these teleological explanations, I don't think you have biological fitness anymore. And I think you end up with statisticalist interpretation where Darwinism just is not possible. So, if we're going to be teleophobic, to use that explanation, we don't have Darwinism anymore. And so that's why I think it's so important. This is why I began with this and then began to apply the reasoning in different ways as sort of further evidence for that. So I don't think my case really rests on the DDR. It rests on the fact that I want to be a Darwinist full on.
I love this guy. Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm definitely outside the field of biology. I'm a physicist, but so maybe this is just a pontificated kind of question. But not only do human beings exist in community, and we reproduce in community, not as individuals, but as communities, it seems that genes are not selfish genes per se, necessarily, but reproducing in communities of genes.
Yeah.
And so have you, I guess, given much thought or understanding to, how does evolution work in terms of communities reproducing themselves? Communities of individuals and communities of genes rather than just selfish genes.
So the fourfold thing that I had, if I understand your question correctly, how to understand communities, right? There's different levels of good, right? There's the good of the gene, there's the good of the organism, and Aristotle actually had a really interesting distinction in his book, De Anima. And it's, when we talk about final causes, we actually are talking about the good that's being aimed at, reproduction, and the thing that sort of benefits from that. The organism doesn't benefit from reproduction, the population does, right? And so in my more complex models, I add in a different level and just talk about the corresponding goods, the beneficiaries at each level. So we can actually have, it becomes remarkably complex, far too complex for an ASA 20-minute talk, about how, like, the goods that you're talking about, populational goods versus, like, organismal goods, which I think is what you're talking about?
It's partly.
Yeah. I think it gets into a real big talk, which I don't have time for, unfortunately. Shoot me an email, please. I'd love to talk about this more.
Thank you very much, Seth.